Okay, I have Professor Leon Surrett on the line. I'm Bob Dobbs. Mr. Surrett is a professor emeritus at the University of Western Ontario. Is that how you say it, emeritus, Leon?
Emeritus.
Emeritus. Oh, yeah, right. I'm going to have to move my phone a little further away. I detect a slight echo. So, Leah, I want to go right into your books. I've read all your books except for the one on the modern dilemma, and Pound and Purgatory. So I've read A Light from Eleusis, The Birth of Modernism, and Dreams of a Totalitarian Utopia. So my first question is, the thesis in A Light from Eleusis, what in particularly did you discover from Mr. William French that entails you to sort of rewrite the history of modernism, focusing on Pound, Eliot, and Yeats and the occult, 10, 15 years later in The Birth of Modernism? What can you explain the slight difference that the realization of what you had written in Light from Eleusis, which is in the 70s. What changed?
Well, what changed was largely that phone call from William French, who was a avowed occultist and a hanger-on in St. Elizabeth's during Pound's years there, during some of Pound's years there anyway.
Right.
William French was astonished that I had discovered, apparently as an outsider, the occult component of the cantos. He was no more surprised than I, since I was unaware I had done any such thing. When I wrote A Light from Eleusis, I was writing from within the purview of New Criticism, in which, with the model that James Joyce had provided of using a mythological parallel to structure what Eliot called the futility and something else of modern life.
Right.
The anarchy and futility, that's not the right phrase. Anyway, so I assumed that the parallel to Eleusis and other sort of cult features, by the way, I should mention that nobody knows what exactly Eleusis represents.
Right.
Represented, it remains a something of a mystery, but Pound used it as a catch-all for cult beliefs, really. Anyway, I had assumed that he used those things just as a mythological parallel, the same way Joyce used Ulysses, the Odyssey, rather, in his novel Ulysses, and Eliot had used the Grail legend in The Wasteland. But William French saw it quite differently. He saw those parallels as a secret wisdom, and a secret wisdom that structured the cantos. So when he told me that, it aroused my curiosity as to how many people there were around and how many were associated with Pound that believed in this sort of secret wisdom that went back to before the Greeks, even back to Egypt. And it's an underground or a cult here, meaning hidden.
Yes.
A cult, as I use it, doesn't mean things that go bump in the night, particularly. It's not about supernatural phenomena. It's about wisdom. Not phenomena, but about knowledge, a knowledge that is shared by present knowers, as Pound calls them somewhere. So that's what led to the second book.
Okay, just for the record, I think I forgot to say this is May 1st, 2014. Okay, so the figures like Circe and others around the story of the Hellenic cults of Eleusis, the mystery religions, for
well,
you...
Eleusis wasn't Hellenic. It's ancient Greek.
Right. But your first notion as a young scholar coming out of, I guess, Eurocentric knowledge is that this is about the Greek gods, and that's the mythological, not the particular occult thing. It's just characters involved with Eleusis and the rituals there, right? That's the beginning... The first perception, that it's just a parallel reference to the religious figures of the Greek culture.
Well, yeah, of Mediterranean culture, one might say.
Right.
There's a lot of Roman stuff in there, too. And it persisted in Pound's view. He was quite explicit about this at some points, but not always. It persisted through the Middle Ages, particularly in such groups as the Albigensians.
Right, but that's the second phase. I'm trying to go back to what the first, in A Light from Eleusis, subtitled A Study of Ezra Pound's Cantos, you're talking about Joyce's parallel method, mythological method, and so he wanted to include, he couldn't do Ulysses, Joyce had done that, so he picked the rituals around Eleusis as the mythic parallel, and that's just a religion of that era. Nothing to do with a stream of secret culture, you know, after that. That's your first interpretation, which would come through normal classical education, right?
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't thinking of a secret culture at all. I was just thinking of a convenient parallel that he could structure his cantos
right.
on. And by the way, he doesn't abandon the Odyssean parallel. He begins, as you may recall,
that's
with
right.
The Nukuya, or calling forth the dead in the Odyssey. So the Odyssey is still there, but it's used in a very different way. It's not the return journey that Joyce used, but the descent that is the
right.
natural.
And so then that, you may not think of it at the time, is a seance, can be seen as a seance, or what
yes.
we call the occult. And that's the part you didn't know or didn't think of.
That's right. That was not in my
right.
in my purview at all when I wrote A Light from Eleusis.
Yeah, being a literary person, you weren't going to mediums in your youth, were you?
No.
And you weren't reading.
No,
tea
in fact, I went to mass as a
oh, the Catholic. So that would really make it distant from you, right? That kind of activity.
Well, not. I don't know that would increase the distance. It would certainly increase the skepticism.
Right, about the occult. So, let's see, what else? Just to really define this. So, it's referring to Mediterranean religious culture, parallel like Joyce, and that's obvious. And nobody had figured out the Eleusis parallel, and was that odd in the first meaning, first time you did the book, was it odd that nobody noticed that parallel to you?
Well, you mean nobody before me, or
yes, before
no
critics.
Yeah, it wasn't. No, I don't think it was odd. I mean, the mythological parallel thing was certainly in the air. Everybody was talking about that.
Yeah.
But the Eleusinian aspect of it, to call it Eleusinian, was a bit problematic because, as I said before, no one knows what the Eleusinian religion was.
Right.
So it was seen more or less as a throwaway in the cantos. It wasn't given.
Right, it's the most insubstantial thing to put your hat on. It's okay, that would explain why no one would really focus on it. What did they focus on as the parallel in previous criticism before you?
The Nostos was the big thing. That is the return journey, which was the big deal. In Joyce's Ulysses, that's what's called. You know, Ulysses is all about his return from Troy to Ithaca.
Right.
At least half of it is. Half of it's about the return, and the other half is about killing off all the suitors and stuff.
Right.
When he finally does return.
Well, what? Okay, so they thought that Pound was just redoing Joyce, or was there another part of the Odyssean story that they saw that Pound picked out?
Joyce concentrated on the Nostos, the return journey, and Pound focused on the Nukuya, or the descent, the underworld. Now, it's often called a descent, but it wasn't technically a descent. It was a calling forth, or as you say, a seance.
Right.
It was the calling forth of the dead. And the reason he called forth the dead was to find out what was going to happen, whether he was going to get back. In other words, it was a request for knowledge.
So it's after the Battle of Troy, he's now starting his return, and this is an action he takes at the very beginning.
Well, not quite, no. It's after Circe that he does
the Oh, okay, he's into the journey a bit.
Yeah.
Right, so then he does this.
It's book 9. There are 12 books, there are 24 books in the Odyssey, and this is book 9.
Well, that's quite far into it then.
Yes.
So it makes total sense. It would make sense for him to single that out as a parallel in the classical literate meaning, but on the occult level, it makes total sense that he would begin with that. Because that
I didn't see it as a cult when I wrote Life of Illusions. I saw it as a journey into the past, and which is what the Cantos is, right? It's an attempt to recover from the past,
right?
The wisdom of the past. But I was thinking of this as secular wisdom, not occult wisdom. And the his slogan, which is almost invariably misinterpreted, his slogan that he used as a title of one of his collections, "Make It New."
Yes.
People take that to mean throw away the old stuff and get new stuff, but of course that's not what it means. It means renovate. It means get the old stuff, shine it up, make it new.
Make the past new.
And that's almost universally misinterpreted by Pound critics as being somebody forward-looking, you know, a futurist.
Right.
He's not that at all. He's I recognize that already in the book, he's very much a nostalgic for the past. You know,
right. But part of the occult tradition is that everything's all happening now, so the past would be part of the present and the future, you know, in the occult tradition.
Well, except that his project was to recover the past, so that implies that he didn't think it was available.
Yeah, he didn't know the occult meaning. Okay,
no.
So it's not strange that it's focused on the ninth book. He had to go through some adventures, make some mistakes, and then he said, I got to find out what's going on here if I want to get back, right?
That's reasonable.
Right.
No way to read it.
So then, Mr. French, did you have many conversations with him? It was a very long conversation. Did he give you details?
Well, it's very like the relationship between you and I. He'd phone me here periodically, and we'd have long conversations.
And he'd tell you about his experiences with Pound at St. Elizabeth.
Oh, yes, he did, yeah.
And so he's amazed that you focus on the Lucis, and he's amazed you don't know what it means in his terms.
Well, he thought I did know. You see, that
right.
was the first thing. How his first conversation with me was, how can you come to know all this stuff unless you're one of us? and I assured him I wasn't one of them. You know, I mean, I wasn't using the us and them thing in a nasty way or anything, but I had no occult leanings or knowledge, as far as I knew. but he saw the book as in fact spot on. For what people like himself believed.
Okay, had he heard from Pound your thesis in reference to the Cantos?
No, I wrote to Pound once when I got no reply. He wasn't talking to anybody much.
Right. So
I'm sure Pound never read it. His daughter has read it.
No, but I'm saying, did French have words from Pound about the Eleusinian meaning of the Cantos? The occult meaning.
Well, it's a bit difficult to answer that question. No, I guess the simple answer is no. But what he told me was what his beliefs were, more or less.
Right.
Conversational.
He
way.
May be the only Pound. Go ahead.
And that they were also Pound's beliefs. In other words, he didn't report to me what Pound said he believed, but what he did tell me was more or less what his
beliefs were,
and that Pound shared those, and he had two groups, or at least two different groups on the lawn in St. Elizabeth's. I can't remember the days, but say on Tuesdays and Thursdays he'd meet his occult gangs would come,
yeah.
And on Mondays and Wednesdays it would be the right-wing fascist. And then on Saturdays it would be the literary types who'd come around to at his feet, that sort of thing.
Yeah, the ones who respected him and signed that petition eventually. Even McLuhan signed that petition, I think.
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Yeah, so...
Yeah, McLuhan, of course, was it's hard to know which side he was on.
That's right. Yeah, that's what we're going to get into a little bit. So French may be the only theosophist, occultist, who read your book, at least back then.
I don't know. I don't think that's true. I went to the McLuhan conference in Toronto. Was this last year or was the year before?
2011.
Anyway. Yeah, okay. 2011?
Years ago. Yeah, because he was born in 1911. So that was the centenary.
Yeah, of course, that's right. Yeah, of course. Anyway, a number of people there had read my second book, The Birth of Modernism, and praised it. And they had nothing good to say about anything else I did, including the paper I read there. But that gave me to believe that the McLuhanites, like yourself, harbor quite a few people with occult leanings.
That's right. Now, they're interested. They're almost replays of William French. They like what you do. They may not. They may be against the occult and think you're exposing Pound, or they're into the occult and they like the fact you talk about it.
Yeah.
And make the point. But you never met anybody in the Pound circle that visited him other than French, who.
No, that's not true. There's another fellow who used to attend the, well, perhaps still does attend the conferences. He teaches in Hong Kong, and God, what's his name? It's not going to come to me. Anyway, he was another St. Elizabeth hanger-on.
Yeah.
When he read my book, he was quite astonished.
And went through the same process, that you finds out that you don't know. He maybe didn't find it out, but he would have been surprised that you weren't an occultist, right?
Yeah, well, this fellow, I'm embarrassed I can't bring his name to mind, but he wasn't himself an occultist, but he knew there were lots of them around.
Hmm. Right.
So he was impressed that I figured this out without any inside help, so to speak.
Right. Okay, so the in your community of Pound scholars, this is considered a bit gauche, what you've done. They're thinking... Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm persona non grata amongst the Poundians.
Right. They think that you're an occultist, it sounds like.
Well, I don't know about that. They, they don't like me because I say mean things about Pound.
You say what? Mean things about Pound?
Yeah, well, the books you haven't read have to do with his fascism and his...
No, but there's a lot of that in the Totalitarian Dreams book. I know what you say about them.
Yeah.
You make Pound, Eliot, Lewis as rather stupid people.
Well, as far as economics is concerned,
yes, very naive.
Well, Eliot kept himself out of that game pretty much, the economics.
Well, no, he engaged in it. He had a vision. I'm just finishing a book called Eliot in Context. It's pretty good. It's a lot of new scholars redoing Eliot, and it's got 37 chapters. They do every aspect of his life, and they have a section on politics, economics, anti-Semitism, everything. But his economic vision was interesting. He was interested in Douglas and these guys, but he had a Christian slant to it and became pretty eccentric, but it was consistent. Once he had converted, he had an economic vision. As a matter of fact, one of the essays shows the wasteland is an economic tract. It's about the failure of the economy kind of thing. And
yeah, well, I think that's nonsense.
You don't see that?
I don't believe it.
Okay. Well, he was thinking of Douglas and that. And
He knew Douglas.
Yeah.
And he was quite good friends with the fellow who took over Douglas's journal, the New English Weekly.
Oraghi? Is that how you say his name? Oraghi?
No, after Oraghi died... his name's not going to come to me. Another chap took it over.
Right, and Eliot knew that person.
Yeah, Murray. Murray is his name, M-A-I-R-E-T.
Oh, yeah, right.
And he was quite chummy with Murray. And he did have a notion of social reconstruction, but I wouldn't say that he had any radical ideas about economics. Basically, he bought into the new agrarianism of the Americans, Southern Americans, and the idea that we could all live in little farms and stuff. And that's very clear in the Four Quartets. He's very nostalgic for an agrarian world with
the Jeffersonian model.
I guess so.
Yeah, versus Hamilton,
without the slavery.
Yeah, right. So, but this thesis says it's not. The economic wasteland is one of the levels. He's not saying the wasteland is all about just that, but it has a material wasteland, economic wasteland, as well as a spiritual or psychological wasteland.
Well, as I say, I don't buy that at all. It was written finished in 1921, remember, long before the
No, Douglas crash. And them were around in the late teens and early 20s, I'm pretty sure.
Oh, yeah, Douglas was there, for sure. Yeah, Douglas. There was no economic disaster as yet. 29 was when things fell apart.
Right, but I think the... from Douglas' point of view, if you're listening to Douglas, you knew that something went wrong that led to First World War, and he's proposing alternatives. I think that influenced. Well, this guy says it influenced.
Anyway, let's forget about him because I think he's off the wall.
Okay, so your regular scholars, it's because you. Can they come up with an argument to disprove your thesis in a light or from Birth of Modernism? Has anybody written a pretty good?
No, they've pretty well been silent. They've been silent on the matter.
Okay.
They shun me in the hall, that sort of thing.
Right.
That's the way they've dealt with it.
All right. So. But it's undeniable that the Theosophical thing was a big deal in the 1890s and 1900s up to 1914 in London. Even Lewis, Wyndham Lewis, spoke at their society. I think it's in your book or some book I read. There's a record
yes,
of him speaking
yeah, at,
there.
Yes, with Mead's splinter group, which
right.
was...
And there's a... It's a pretty good Yale... Paul Edwards does the definitive Yale... almost coffee table book on Wyndham Lewis, comes out about 2000. You can see in some of the things he, obscure stuff he brings out of Lewis's life and ideas, there's the occult influence. Lewis's interest in Atlantis and things like that, you know? So there's a bit of the theosophical image in there in Lewis's thinking, even up into the 40s. So,
well, I don't know. Lewis was pretty hard-headed. I don't think he was terribly... everybody, played with these ideas. Anyway, it's difficult. You're talking about theosophical influence, but what do you mean by it, theosophical influence? That's the thing that I guess if we want to
right, but
carry
it,
on this discussion, we're going to have some attributes that you can identify as.
Well, I'm actually the people you lay out in the antecedent scholars going back to the French Revolution. I'm thinking they influenced Blavatsky, and she cobbled together stuff from those guys. It's actually not limited to it doesn't begin with theosophy. She puts it together.
Oh, no, it certainly doesn't begin with her theosophy. No, but if you look up theosophy in the OED, you'll see that the term goes back to long before Madame Blavatsky.
Right, I'm thinking of Blavatsky.
Blavatsky's theosophy is a cobbled together thing. It largely comes out of New England.
Yes, that's right. What's his name? Alcott?
Not Alcott. No, Alcott's there, but he's a disciple of hers. But there's a fellow whose name's not going to come to me.
Right.
Who was quite a heavyweight scholar that helped ghostwrite her book.
Right. Okay, so I wanted to. Yeah. So what else about that? So. I think it's interesting. I think you got a valid thesis there. And I think it's really, since it was a big fad to do seances and mediumship, Pound, I think even Eliot almost has it in his works. He has it in The Wasteland, maybe in Prufrock, I can't remember. And then you got Pound doing it. Joyce.
But you described that as my thesis. My thesis doesn't include Eliot as one of the people.
I'm not saying this. I'm just saying that I'm supporting what you're saying because Joyce, Eliot, Pound, and Lewis, and Yeats, all of them engaged in going to mediums. And
No. Yeats certainly.
No, but it's not on the record about Joyce, but I have other sources on that. So you don't have to believe me. But if this is what I found out in my research. They all went and dabbled in it. Not that they believed it, but they tried it out because it was a big...
Theosophy and spiritualism are two quite distinct.
Yes.
Spiritualism derives from the Fox sisters, who, like Blavatsky, were clear frauds. It had been exposed quite clearly as frauds.
Right.
going to seances and communing with the dead was certainly very popular, especially during the First War when there were so many dead to communicate with.
Yeah.
And Yeats believed in all that stuff for sure, but
yes.
These other people did not.
Well, yeah, they didn't necessarily believe it, but they tried it out, or they were in groups that did it, and they went along to look at it. Maybe they laughed at it. The point is they would include it in their pop cultural references, in their metaphors, in their poetry, in their
That's true.
Covering
That's
the true. Culture.
Yeah, sure. They would include war and booze and all sorts of other things. I mean,
and so there it is. And now you're going a little further than them just bringing it in as part of the culture and saying, no, Pound believed in this.
Yes, and, Pound, but not the others.
Not the others, but Pound, and that makes him even more crackpot in relation to the mainstream. That's what they don't want to hear that either, right?
That's correct.
Yeah, okay. But you're pretty, William French proves to you, if you believe William, that Pound was into it that deeply. Because he had meetings on it.
Yes.
Right. Okay. So.
And it started. By the way, in New England, you know, he read Swedenborg when he was in. He became very close to Yeats, and of course Yeats was very deeply into it.
Yeah. It's obvious Pound was interested in it. Eliot and Lewis, bit ambiguous, ambivalent, and Joyce.
Well, Eliot, as you know, converted to Anglicanism, which excludes.
Right.
He can't
would
be an Anglican. A serious Anglican as he was.
But that's after the Wasteland.
That's after the Wasteland, yeah.
Yeah. So, okay, so I just wanted to get it clear what the difference was between A Light from Eleusis and The Birth of Modernism. What is the difference? Now, maybe a subplot to that is that when did you learn about the Amor cult, the love cult, that ancient sect or whatever?
Well, I never did learn about it. I don't know that it even exists, but Pound certainly invokes that, and he uses the little trick that Amor is Roma backwards.
Right.
So it's the antithesis of the Catholic religion, and he's very ambivalent about his attitude towards Catholicism.
Yes.
Especially after the Concordat in Italy, but anyway, he admired the institution, but not the beliefs. Accepted so far as they were mystical. Anyway, the cult of Amor, insofar as it exists at all, is Pound. Pound thinks it goes much further. But anyway, it was this stuff going on in the Albigensian
Crusade area.
Yeah.
Era.
And
the troubadours.
The troubadours. And the troubadours invented what we call romantic love. There's been lots of scholarship about that. But up until the troubadours talked about love that was a kind of transformational experience, sexual love was lust.
Right. Now, is that what you're saying is the Amor theme?
The Amor theme is that and it, of course, it has a philosophical background, if you like, or support through Neoplatonism. Neoplatonism argues that you can ascend from the flesh into the spirit, and one of the roots of ascent is sexual or sexual transport.
And that sounds like William Reich.
Yes.
Reich
retrieved that. He's a little later in the
scene. Yeah.
Sure. There's lots of people believe that, but it really dates as far as pop culture, popular culture is concerned, from the troubadours in 12th century France, where sexual love became a transformative experience.
Right. So
and also the other aspect, by the way, of sexual love that the troubadours introduced was unrequited love, and that's what.
That's another way to transcend.
Well, that's a way of spiritualizing it. I mean,
right.
I guess some people now do believe, but the idea that ejaculation was somehow spiritual.
Right.
And of course, it was the unrequited love that the troubadours had was because the troubadours were lower class people, and they were expressing admiration for the lady of the manor.
Right.
And they had to whom they had no real physical access. So you get the idea. of love, not as something that leads to sexual transport, but that
you pine away.
It's transcendent, right?
Freud
picked up on that with his theory of people work hard to succeed at this, that, and the other thing as an alternative to sexual release.
Yeah.
Sublimation, he called it.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So
that's unrequited.
That's right. That's unrequited. Yeah. Well, that's right. Instead of going out and raping or wooing women, you go and make money. You know, write books.
Write books. Become a professor.
Exactly. Yeah.
So what was I going to say about that? But I looked up in the wiki the other day, and I think they extended back to, you know, Mediterranean culture. That's a theory, right? It really begins with the troubadours, but if you believe there's something before then, which is part of the occult tradition, then you can say the Amor cult may be back in pre-Christian times. Is that?
Well, for a lot of people, yeah, a lot of people put it back into Eleusis, in fact. There was the Eleusinian rite, some people argued, in the Renaissance at least, some people argued that it culminated with a copulation between a priest and a priestess.
Right, yeah.
So that Eleusis itself was a cult of Amor.
But it wasn't called Amor back then. That's modern term, back.
This is Renaissance speculation. I don't think there are any ancient sources for that speculation. But I'm not sure. I've forgotten. It's a long time since I looked at that stuff. But in any event, the ancient world wasn't oblivious to sexual behavior.
Right.
You don't want to make that mistake. And most of the myths. The Jewish myths are pretty asexual. They have very little to do with sex, but almost all the other myths in the world look at sexual behavior as a central human thing and something that usually has to do with interrelations between mortals and immortals. You know, they're all those divine rapes, right? And Pound uses that phrase, the hieros gamos,
right,
in the Cantus, which
hieros
means divine
gamos
wedding,
yeah,
which means a divine or holy wedding, which of course Christianity has embedded that in it too, because after all, Christ is the son of a mortal and a divinity and God.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, and then there's that passage in the Old Testament of the sons of the gods and the daughters of men.
Yeah,
that part. But did the word Amor come in with the Renaissance?
Well, it's a Latin word, so.
Yeah, the scholars made it up.
Just a Latin word meaning love, you know.
Right.
Not,
there doesn't seem to be any mention of the Amor, that term, back 2,000 years ago.
Well, not as a cult, but
right.
Sure, there's lots of talk about sexual activity, but
not as a cult.
Love is a, as we use it today, it doesn't mean lust.
Right.
Right. So the idea of Amor is not love, and is, you know, motherly love or fatherly love or brotherly love, or it means sexual activity that is somehow transcendent.
Right. Okay.
You know, the other thing.
Yeah,
I suppose that comes up here, which is very relevant these days, is so-called platonic love.
Yes.
Now, platonic love is often used to mean love that isn't sexual, but in fact, for Plato, it was love between men.
Yes.
Sexual behavior between men. And
right.
Which was love. I mean, and Aristotle actually has an interesting passage somewhere, I've forgotten, in the Ethics or somewhere, that relations between men and women can never truly be love relationships. The only true love is between men.
Right, yeah.
And not between two men of the same age either, by the way, between a man and a boy.
Yeah, yeah.
Because the relationship between a man and a woman is embedded in the world. It leads to reproduction, which means it's debased and not,
yeah,
not the real thing.
Okay, so one more thought on that. Did I mention to you, reading your books, I thought that James Bond always engages Cersei in his films.
Bond?
Yes, in
it. You mean the writer?
No, Bond, the character in the James Bond films, the book, the writer was.
Yeah,
Ian
but
Fleming.
He doesn't. James Bond doesn't write them, though.
In pretty well every James Bond movie, the first woman he has has sex with is usually a bad person and ends up dying. You know, she's a spy and a double agent on him.
And she dies.
Cersei
never dies.
I know, but it's the idea that this Cersei is pretty dangerous. You got to watch it when you engage with her. So I was thinking that that's embedded in all the James Bond movies, and then he sometimes has a relationship that works out a little better in the second time around in the later part of the film. You know, second woman comes in and helps him. But he always has, it's almost like an initiation. But he seems to be aware, he's on top of it. He survives it every time, but he goes for it every time. Here's a new Cersei. This is going to be fun, but she's going to double-cross me at some point. And then that happens, and she dies. And then that's before the middle of the movie, so to speak.
Okay.
So anyways, I didn't mention that to you before.
No.
You don't recall it. So that's my pop culture adaptation of an archetype. It happened.
Yeah, well, you realize that in the Odyssey, after Odysseus sleeps with Cersei, he's protected by a plant or a drug called moly, so that he isn't turned into a beast like all his men.
Right.
And it also, this is in fact a conquest of Cersei, and she then allows him. It was after that he goes and talks to the dead.
And what? She?
It's after his conquest of Cersei that Odysseus, the Nekuya takes place after that.
I see. Okay, good. So and that's where you get the Eleusis reference point. You know, he survived the mystery. Oh no! Wait, he goes down to the exchange after.
I don't think it works that way.
Does he maybe engage another goddess in the Eleusian?
Well, he spends 10 years on the island of Calypso with Calypso, who's minor divinity.
Right.
Best of both worlds. He has his wife waiting patiently for him.
Right.
Ithaca.
Okay, so he survived. So the Bond thing is that he doesn't get fooled by the dangerous woman, he's then got a bit of grace. And he can keep going all the way. And that way he's kind of protected. Not by her, so they don't do it exactly. He's not protected by her. He slayed her, or she got slayed. But maybe the second one always comes in and helps him. So that's the transformed Cersei. That's what that is. The second woman that helps him is the Cersei, the protecting factor.
Well, Pound builds that into the cantos, but it's not the way you describe it.
No.
After he leaves the island of Calypso, he's shipwrecked.
Yeah.
And he survives alone. All his men die.
They're turned to swine, right?
No. This is long after that.
Oh, okay.
This is the shipwreck. And he's rescued by a water sprite called Leucothoe. And Pound has that, built that into cantos. He has several references to Leucothoe, who is a water sprite, a female water sprite that saves Odysseus from drowning.
But then, he ends up engaging with Calypso.
No. This is after Calypso.
Is shipwreck after Calypso?
Yeah.
Oh, I see. So then, and he's saved again by the sprite. And then what's he do then?
Then he disguises himself as an old ne'er-do-well, is a bagman, I guess you might say.
Pensioner. Hmm? Homeless pensioner.
A pensioner, whatever. And sneaks into his palace, where he's not recognized except by his dog. who he's been away for 10 years, but the dog is still around. Actually, it's more than 10 years. Anyways, then he talks to his wife, who doesn't recognize him, of course, but doesn't believe that he's Odysseus, but he persuades her that he really is by pointing out that the bed, their marriage bed, is actually built out of a tree, out of a living tree, it's not. And nobody else would know that because he did that with his own hands.
Right.
And then he kills all the suitors.
Right. But
bloodbath. Very nice Hollywood ending.
So American ending. Yeah. Hollywood American. So that wreckage and the sprite saves them, that's pretty close to home. So once
he ends up on the island of Ithaca, his home. Yeah.
Oh, he's saved and he's wrecked just as he gets there.
Yeah.
And then saved. Okay. All right. So the next point, this is a slightly different. The three genres, lyric, epic, and dramatic, is that a classification system in Stephen Hero invented by Joyce, or was that part of literary knowledge?
That goes back to the Renaissance, at least. Certainly the difference. No, it goes back to Aristotle's Poetics, actually.
Oh, okay, so he makes those three
Well,
categories.
He doesn't really talk about lyric much. He distinguishes epic and tragedy. I guess he does talk about lyric, too, yeah. And it goes back to Aristotle's Poetics.
Well, Marshall, do you remember him teaching you about lyric, epic, and the dramatic as opposed to tragedy? Did you ever hear him say that to you?
Well, he talked a lot about what I do recall. I don't recall that. I mean, that wouldn't be news to me anyway.
Right.
But he talked a lot about the Apuleian. That was the
yes.
big thing with him back then, which is the little epic.
That's right. Now, that was my next question, is that if you read Eric's thesis, PhD on Manipian satire, and Don Field did a essay with McLuhan, I think it was a book on Tennyson, and he did a lot of research and worked on that with Marshall, the Apuleian is really can be a Manipian. The Manipian
yes,
satire goes into the Apuleian form. Have you ever heard of that? Did Marshall tell you?
Oh, yeah, he talked about that. Yeah, he used to talk about that a lot.
Now, that's pretty esoteric literary knowledge. I don't think many professors were teaching that in the 50s and 60s, were they? Did you know of any?
Well, I wouldn't call it esoteric. Eccentric would be a more appropriate epithet, I think.
Yeah, because he writes in cliched archetype that it's a forgotten form, and he puts it onto the Cantos, the Wasteland, and Ulysses. He mixes Manipian satire and the Apuleian. Now, Ulysses
yeah.
is epic, but it has a lot of Apuleia in it, maybe, or Fitting His Wake is a series of Apuleia. That's what Eric says. But the mixing of Manipian and Apuleia is pretty unique to McLuhan, and he makes a big deal out of it. He says that's the missing categorization that 20th century literary scholars miss.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe not now, but would you agree back in the 50s, early 60s?
Well, I would agree that most other people weren't talking about it, whether it's a discovery or not.
Right. No, it had a tradition.
Sure. And yeah. The Wasteland fits that category better than anything else.
Right.
Certainly. For Pound, he thought the Cantos were an epic, not
right.
an Apuleian.
Right. And do you know if Pound ever mentioned the Apuleian?
I don't remember. No, I don't think so.
Okay. So, it's a bit too broad the way Marshall uses it, but it's more...
Well, I don't know that. It's just that it's not entirely clear what it achieves. But, generic classification is not a... It's not a growth industry in literary criticism. It wasn't then.
Right, right.
So nobody really cared whether... But people did, to backtrack a little bit, people did speculate about the Wasteland. What was it? Because it's too short to be a narrative. It's not a narrative poem. It's not a lyric poem. It's not a dramatic poem. So people did struggle with some kind of generic classification for that rather unique poem. And in fact, Eliot never repeated that. I, in fact, wrote a paper many, many years ago, very early in my career, arguing that it was an imitation of musical sonata form.
Right.
And it is, which is a five-part structure. And Eliot, as you may know, was quite fond of the five-part structure. Each of the four quartets is,
yes,
a five-part structure. And then, of course, a quartet is a musical analogy again, so...
Did you see,
but anyway, that,
were you aware of Marshall's writings in the 70s where he started to emphasize the five-part structure, basing on the five parts of rhetoric? Did you ever read or hear that?
I was aware of it, but I wasn't interested in it, and I never sort of studied it up.
Right, and he didn't teach it in the early 60s, did he?
Not that I'm aware of.
Yeah, he claimed it was a discovery he and Eric made. They'd find the five-part structure based on the five parts of rhetoric all over the place. And,
yeah. What I found was the five-part structure of sonata form.
Right. Yeah, Marshall's last sort of literary paper essay written in 78 or so was the five-part structure of The Wasteland, which you would agree with.
Yeah. Oh, well, everyone has to agree with that. It's got five numbered parts.
Well, maybe I should say the rhetorical parallel. You might not agree with that then.
No. Well, the rhetorical parallel is a different matter, yeah.
Right. You would accept that? What, the rhetoric?
I don't know enough about it to either accept
or
reject it.
All right, so here's an interesting pattern. Talking about Joyce's mythological method or parallel, Eric McLuhan has a small essay where he says the Dubliners is epic and then redone as Ulysses. Exiles is dramatic, the third category, redone as Finnegan's Wake. Finnegan's Wake is a drama, a play, you know, not just a book or a poem or prose. There's this dramatic. And there is actual movie script and everything in Finnegan's Wake, so it sounds like you can make that. Now, what's interesting, he says that, what am I leaving out? So there's two things I'm saying here. Ulysses redoes Dubliners. That's epic. Finnegan's Wake redoes... I got it wrong.
Redoes Exiles.
Okay, yes. And then Portrait of the Artist redoes Chamber Music, or maybe Stephen Hero. Okay. Now, that's one theme, using the three categories. The other point is that Dubliners is based on Ovid's Metamorphoses. Ulysses is based on Homer's Odyssey. Finnegan's Wake is based on everything. And Exiles is based on Medea, you know, the Greek play?
Yeah.
M-E-D-E-A. Can you see that?
No. No, that strikes me as...
pretty far, because
it's not just that it's implausible. It's just useless. I mean, even if you agree that that's the case, it doesn't tell you anything. It doesn't. There's no yield to it. There's no benefit to it. There's no hermeneutic yield. It doesn't help you to understand any of those works in the slightest bit.
Okay.
It's a stretch to make those claims.
So I tried to see if it could fit and. I read up on Medea. I've never seen it. There's a movie, I think, but I've never seen it. And so reading up, basically, you know, she's killing everybody. Now, is there, and I've seen Exiles once, haven't reread it, so I can't say I'm strong in my mind, but is the two guys are fighting over the woman, does she hurt both of them?
Emotionally, you mean, or physically?
Yeah. Did you know the play well enough to remember it?
I can't remember. No, I don't remember it well.
Because I'm thinking,
it struck me as a very uninteresting play. It's an imitation of Ibsen, and I've never been able to get into Ibsen either, for that matter. But it's about relationships that are Ibsen and Exiles, male-female relationships that are
disasters.
Well, not just disasters, but terribly constrained by social...
Yeah. So could that be a kind of death? I'm trying to figure, give Eric the benefit of the doubt and say, okay, is there some kind of
emotional murder going on in Exiles by the woman.
Yeah, I can't remember well enough to.
Too much of a stretch. Okay, so, all right, so that was just a side thing I wanted to get into. So, now, let's see. A Light from Eleusis, The Birth of Modernism, and Dreams of a Totalitarian Utopia. I think maybe that's all I'm going to do right now on that point. I want to go into your Art in the Age of the Machine. Is that title? Art in the
Art in the Age of the Machine.
Yeah. That's very interesting, you know, almost 200-year history of art versus the machine.
Not versus the machine, but art.
Art and the machine. But your first chapter is Art Against the Machine, I think.
That's correct, but that was the initial, that was
the first crisis, you know, 200 years ago or something.
Yeah.
Now, I've taken a quote from your review of Don Thiel's Beyond the Word. And I think this is pretty good, and it read it in the record here. You're talking about reflexivity. And you say, Thomas Kuhn's work, though initially highly controversial, has prevailed among historians of science. It is clearly reflexive, like McLuhan's theory or presentation, and Worf's. And also provides a theory of cultural change. Even though Kuhn's shifts are the result of human investigation and cogitation, his theory conforms to epochalism and holism in that the change takes place all at once rather than piecemeal. Then you say, a variety of reflexivity very much in vogue within postmodernism is Marxist cultural theory. For Marx, the Weltanschauung, or paradigm, is generated by the economic base, the means of production and its ownership. So that's the medium, right? The economic base.
I wouldn't say that, no.
Not the exact way McLuhan meant it, but it is a structure.
It's not the medium, no.
It's a structure.
Not the medium. It's the base.
The base, right. That's the term. So then you have in paleo-Marxism, the Weltanschauung is called superstructure, ideology, or false consciousness, and can be altered only by an overthrowing or Aufhebung. Is that how you say that? Aufhebung?
Yeah, Aufhebung. Yeah.
Aufhebung.
Hegelian term.
Right, of the base which generates it. Neo-Marxism, under the influence of the Italian Marxist Antonio Gramsci and the Frankfurt School, permits top-down alteration of false consciousness through direct, quote, consciousness raising, unquote. One of the members of the Frankfurt School, Herbert Marcuse, was responsible for the hippie slogan, Make Love, Not War, which reflected the cultural analysis of his Eros and Civilization, Beacon Press, 1955. McLuhan's hypothesis was sometimes thought to be Marxist because it is both reflexive and materialistic. Indeed, it is distinct from the hermeneutic, the Worfian, and the Kuhnian hypotheses by virtue of the role it assigns material instantiation of communication media. But unlike Marxism, the McLuhan hypothesis takes the process of cultural change to be ineluctable, unmanipulable, and politically innocent. Initially, McLuhan focused on the contrasted pair of acoustic/verbal and visual/alphabetic notations of language, arguing that electronic broadcasting would restore the archaic acoustic/verbal culture. However, the iconic nature of television obliged him to extend his hypothesis beyond linguistic notation, and this got him into all sorts of theoretical problems. Those difficulties contributed mightily to the decline of McLuhanism. But today, encapsulated in the slogan, the medium is the message, the McLuhan hypothesis is now widely invoked in prophecies about how computers and the internet will alter human society and culture in radical and unprecedented ways. Apart from computers and the internet, it is also the case that the positivism that dominated the academy in 1962 has been largely displaced by varieties of reflexivity and or pluralism. The most radical and most influential reflexive doctrine of the 90s is called deconstruction. It derives from the French philosopher Jacques Derrida. In a nutshell, deconstruction is a nihilistic version of the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis and quite accidentally is a mirror image of the McLuhan hypothesis. In Derrida's epochalist story, it is the acoustic/verbal that is demonized and the visual/graphic that is privileged. Now, there's one little later paragraph in the paper.
That's pretty good stuff there.
Yeah, very good summarizing a lot of the 150 years. And that's what I'm going to lead into. But there's another thing you write a little later in the paper The Sapir-Whorf hypothesis is scandalous for those who believe that human knowledge is universally comprehensible and universally valid, if valid at all. The McLuhan hypothesis is equally scandalous for them, for others, but also for those, okay, the McLuhan hypothesis is equally scandalous for the ones who are scandalized by Sapir-Whorf, is what you mean, but also for those who believe that human thought is free and autonomous of its instantiations in tools, machines, and media. The Derrida hypothesis is scandalous for all of the foregoing, and also for those who believe that human thought is some purchase on a world which is independent of it. The Kuhnian hypothesis, the most modest of them all, is scandalous only for those who believe that science is totally independent of the culture which generates it. So that's a very good summary for a student today to cover this phenomenon of reflexivity. So I got a couple.
That was written about 20 years ago, I think.
Yeah, Beyond the Word, yeah. Then 1995 is when the book came out. And
that's when you wrote that. Yeah.
Right. Now, I want to ask a bit about the term reflexivity. Isn't that a later postmodern term, or does that come from somebody in the 19th century?
No. Reflexivity is a logical term. I don't know what the date of it is, but it's certainly not.
It's modern.
No, it's not modern at all. The phenomenon is its dominance in the intellectual thought is modern, but not the term. Reflexivity simply means is the claim that what we believe determines what we think.
Okay.
In other words, our thought is not generated by reason and evidence, but is a projection.
You're programmed somehow. You're programmed, conditioned. Subconscious factors are in there.
Yeah, it's like Marx says the false consciousness
that's reflexivity, not knowing.
Well, it's an instance of reflexivity,
yeah.
but it's one that should be overthrown because, as he believed, as the Industrial Revolution changed the way people behaved, the way people lived, they would eventually change the way they thought.
Right.
That doesn't seem to happen.
Okay, so what when I said modern, okay, we have postmodern. Reflexivity, you're saying, and in the category, the phase before postmodern is the modern era. You know, it might even go back. They argue over where did modernism begin, you know, Renaissance or 1800s and different things. But you're saying reflexivity comes out of the modern era, 19th century.
No, I'm not saying that at all. What I just said was reflexivity is a general condition that exists from time immemorial, if it exists at all. It's nothing to do with modernism.
The term itself has been around a long time?
Yes.
Okay. So
and the phenomenon has been around even longer.
Yes. But I'm interested in the term because you see encountered it with Generation X younger people when I'd read some of their abstract papers or something. They would talk about this term reflexivity, which I don't recall in the 40s, 50s, and 60s being used.
Well, it may not have been widely current, but if you go to the OED, you'll see it probably goes back at least to the 18th century.
Right, okay. So is there any particular philosopher modern philosopher who's known to have used it? Did Hegel use it?
I don't know if he used the term, but Hegel believed that ideology was the way things worked. Marx is a Hegelian, and the thing that Marx, Hegel, as far as intellectual history is concerned, is his notion that the thesis, antithesis, and
synthesis,
Aufhebung, or overthrow.
Right.
Thesis. In other words, people believe this X, Y, or Z. They believe that you know, they believe that the Earth, the sun goes around the Earth. Let's say, to use a Kuhnian example, they believe that the sun goes around the Earth. So that's the thesis. But then the antithesis is the discovery. Let's say that no, the Earth goes around the sun. Okay.
Right.
So and then there becomes then you have to rejig everything, and that's the overthrow. You have to rejig everything you think about. You're sitting on a stable platform with everything going around it. But in fact, you're on a spinning globe that itself is spinning around the sun.
Right.
And so that's a whole different.
Is that what they call the third phase synthesis? that
I don't know anything about third phase synthesis, but yeah, I guess, well, yeah, that's the synthesis. Yeah, excuse me, that is
yeah.
the That is the synthesis.
It may not be resolved, but it does overthrow the thesis antithesis concept.
Yeah, you got thesis antithesis synthesis. That's
right.
But these were for Hegel. These were all taking place not in response to evidence, but these were autonomous, rational. He was a rationalist, right?
Right.
And what Marx said was that what Hegel's right about this, except the thesis is determined not by by rational thought, but by the forms of life,
the environment,
by the social and essentially the social environment. Yes,
right.
Not the physical environment, but the social environment.
And is there a reflexivity element in Hegel's in that dialectic?
No.
Okay.
No, because he was a rationalist, so
right.
he believed that the reason was independent, but reflexivity. Argues that you think what you want to think, basically. You believe what you want to believe.
But then the 20th century, you begin with Worf and St. Pierre, they start getting particular about it. Your language is what makes you believe what you want to believe.
Yes, that's another form. That's still reflexivity, but that's right. You can't think outside your language. You can't
right.
think outside the box. The expression thinking outside the box is sort of an aspect of this, right?
Right.
It's a dumbed down aspect, but thinking outside the box, meaning what people mean by that is saying something that's completely ridiculous and that no one would believe, but that's thinking outside the box.
That's right.
It's thinking outside the paradigm, thinking outside the Weltanschauung, you know.
Thinking outside of the social conditioning.
Yeah, stuff like that.
Or some people say belief system.
So, but thinking outside the box is an assertion that reflexivity, I'm not governed by reflexivity.
Right.
I'm an independent thinker.
Yeah. So you've got Marx is aware of reflexivity, or can be categorized.
Yeah. Marx's whole idea, notion of ideology, is that the ideology determines what you believe, right? And so you see what you want to see.
Right. Now, does Marx use the term reflexivity? Have you read enough Marx?
I expect so.
Okay.
It wouldn't be odd
because it was around before Marx.
Yes.
Right.
Well, again, I don't know why you put so much stress on the term. I'm not sure about the term, but the notion that what we believe determines what we, you know, that our pre-existing beliefs, our prejudices, have an influence on what we believe is true of the world, it's been around a long time.
Right, okay, so what's different is that Marx sort of starts to say he starts to hint at the environment, calling it the industrial structure, superstructure, or base, is a factor. He starts to pin down, and then Worf and Sapir make it language,
yeah.
Then McLuhan makes it media, then Derrida inverts McLuhan's media specifications, and Kuhn makes it Hegelian, like Aufhebung?
No, Kuhn just draws attention to the fact that science, that the physical sciences are susceptible to this kind of thing.
This determinism almost, but it's not exact determinism.
That's what some people call it, but it's not determinism.
Right.
It is with Marx. Marx was a determinist.
Yes.
I guess to an extent, McLuhan was too. I mean, he kept insisting that these procedures were automatic and had nothing to do with.
But he
anything.
Said you could become aware of them and develop your reflexivity meter.
Yeah.
Okay, so what's interesting, the way you put this together, I don't know anybody else has done this, is, you know, there are Generation Xers, I call them, who write books and papers talking about reflexivity, and they don't seem to know that's what McLuhan means. You know, they don't get the McLuhan angle of reflexivity.
Perhaps not. I don't read those folks, so I don't know.
I just met a lot of them through the years. I've read a lot of essays on McLuhan. So I encountered the generation, next generation. Now there's a new generation, you know, the next gang. And they're interested in the Menippean satire part. And that's what's interesting about the younger kids.
By the way, what you've just said is a... is an instance of reflexivity, right? You're dividing
epoch
human thought up into generations that each generation thinks in a specific way.
Right.
Which that's very much a sort of application of the Kuhnian hypothesis. Like the Kuhnian hypothesis goes back to the hermeneutics, particularly.
Dilthey. The what? What'd you say?
The hermeneutics.
Hermeneutic.
The German hermeneutic school, which believed that cultures came in packages, and that you know.
Who's a name? Who's a beginning name for that? For hermeneutics.
It goes back to Dilthey.
Yeah.
Dilthey is the most important name.
Okay.
Schleiermacher. Dilthey used Schleiermacher, who was a biblical scholar. As a sort of his guru,
right?
But Dilthey, who his most important essay, I guess, was written in around 1900 on this particular point. His most important essay on this particular point, or at least his inaugural essay. His Florowit was in the late Victorian period,
right?
But he's German, of course, not
as D I L T H E Y.
Yeah.
Yeah. Did you teach this view in your classes? What you wrote here, what
not.
I read.
I did. I get it. When I taught the criticism course, yeah, I would have tried to teach people this.
You cover the waterfront, show the whole.
Yeah.
Okay, so here's an idea. McLuhan pointed out, he would, if he was around today, he would say that reflexivity and in the proliferation of these patterns or theories from different schools of thought, but they're all talking about reflexivity, is a product of an environment where technologies turn over so fast that people can begin to see that they were asleep in one phase and now are in another phase and they got a new bias. So he actually can explain why reflexivity becomes prominent, you know, by the end of the 20th century. You see what I'm saying?
Not exactly. This is why people talk about it?
Yes. McLuhan would notice that reflexivity, that awareness of, say, structuralism, Sapir-Whorf, and McLuhan would be saying this from the position that people don't get him. They would say he's a theorist and he's just redoing Sapir-Whorf. And McLuhan said, no, I'm explaining why Sapir and Whorf showed up in the 20th century and that the reflexivity started to be a more widely known phenomenon. The hidden ground of that was the electric turnover. That's what McLuhan would say.
Well, he might say that. I would not agree with that, except to the extent that modern communications means everybody gets to know the same thing at the
right.
same time.
Yeah.
So that cliches reverberate quickly, and that's basically what we've got here is a rather lumpen belief that each generation has a new perspective on the world, which is, I think, sheer nonsense. They don't. They have a new sense of self-awareness, yes, and they exploit that, yes. But
to the degree that
the McLuhanite view would be, of course, that the internet has created a new consciousness and
a new kind of awareness.
Then the smartphone creates a new sense of consciousness. And so
right.
And so
now, McLuhan would say...
And that's everybody believes that now.
Right.
But I don't believe it.
Right. But McLuhan would say, he would point out that you guys are noticing reflexivity because you're not aware of a deeper reflexivity, a deeper womb or box is making you notice these shifts.
I don't understand what you mean by that. What's the deeper box?
Okay, so he used to say that the reason he and Innes discovered what they discovered was it was the first time culture had so many technologies, you know, every 20 years in the first half of the 20th century, that we started to realize, oh, man, we changed. We are different from the radio era.
But as I just mentioned to you, this perspective goes back at least to the Victorian period and the hermeneutics who argued exactly that.
But they wouldn't say that the population was...
Yes, they would.
They'd say that they were a victim or
Weltanschauungs, or what they argued was this Weltanschauung worldview permeated the entire culture, top to bottom. Everybody...
Everybody was tuned in. Everybody changed and got it.
Well, no, no, not everybody's got it, and then eventually it changes. Yeah, but they thought the cycles were more like a century, rather
right?
Than a decade. But,
so okay, so here's where it's interesting is that McLuhan did when they reissued The Bias of Communication by Innes in 1972. He wrote a new intro for it, and he begins saying that Hegel saw the figure ground situation. That was his Gestalt term. Categories that Innes and he saw, but Hegel made it a concept, not a materialistic perceptual process. Didn't see it grounded in technology or grounded in something. It was an abstract spirit. You get what I'm saying? That Hegel.
Well, I don't know. Now you've introduced the Gestalt theory of figure ground, which is a quite a different psychological theory, psychological theory rather than a cultural theory.
But McLuhan used it as a cultural theory.
It has cultural applications, that's right, but I don't know what our audience would understand what figure ground is, because you've introduced that now.
That's all right. The people
basically, the Gestalt idea is that looking at anything, and this is a visual perceptual theory initially.
Yeah.
Looking at anything, you have to decide which part of what's appearing on your retina is the relevant thing that you want to pick out and identify, and which is simply the background that, they like to have. They used ink blots.
Right.
Ink blot test.
The Rorschach test.
That's an ink blot. And some people would see a naked couple copulating, and other people would see a duck swimming, and that sort of thing. This would tell you all sorts of things about the deep psychology of the people that are doing these things to.
And you know what McLuhan called that? The user is the content. That was his phrase for that phenomenon.
Yeah, yeah. But that figure ground thing, it doesn't map easily onto cultural theory, because the cultures aren't that simple.
Right. Well, he would say that the figure ground that you're citing, the original theoretician, that's visually biased. He then took it.
Well, it was a visual theory. It wasn't visually biased. It was a theory about
visual theory. Well, McLuhan said there's non-visual figure ground relationships.
Yeah, but that's where it falls apart. I mean, what does that mean?
Well, it's a tough one to get. I don't know if I can explain
you can't, because it doesn't mean anything, Bill.
Well, you remember how he would say you couldn't see the present.
He'd say lots of things. McLuhan was, he was a poet.
He wasn't a
philosopher.
Okay, he would say that you couldn't see the present ground, but you could see the effects in the medium. And what was the medium? The past orientation of the society. And you'd see it would be starting to have stresses and strains. You'd say, oh, man, everybody wants more acoustic than visual. So he'd say that would be the evidence that a change was happening. He would look at the past, see the tensions that were surfacing in the old institutions. People think the medium as a message refers to the new medium. The new technology, the new environment is a hidden effect on the past, which is the medium. So you can tell that something's going on because the medium has changed. The past is having problems. So that's a non-visual. It wouldn't be limited to figure ground visual perception. You would look at all senses and the institutions aligned with them and how they change. That would be how he looked at it, how he would notice that there was there's something sneaking around us. Like you used to say, that doesn't make sense to you?
No.
Okay, well, I don't want to turn this into a propaganda meeting, so we'll just let you work on that in your private, in your own relaxation. But that's how I see McLuhan. That's how.
Well, what most people, including me, understand by the medium as a message is that when you change, say, from oral to written,
visual,
or
oral to visual or visual
just
to oral.
Stick with it. Oral to written. Let's leave it to oral to written. Okay?
Right.
When you change from oral to written, it changes the way you think. It changes your whole view of the world, because now you now have a visual medium, whereas before you had an acoustic medium.
Right.
But it's the medium that causes the change. The acoustic poem, for example, let's say the Homer's
Iliad,
when it was acoustic was one thing, but when it was written down, which happened 800 years after it was composed, if that's the right word for what happened to it, it becomes a different thing, and people's attitude to it is different. So the McLuhan's point was that even though the story remains the same, the story of the Iliad is the same whether written or
danced
or recited.
Yeah.
The story is the same, but the impact on the person that is either reading it or hearing it is quite different. Now, that's probably true. Exactly where McLuhan's theory sort of goes into smoke is in determining what exactly that difference is, and that's where it becomes very difficult. I mean, I think everyone can agree that reading, listening to the Iliad recited by a rhapsode over 3 or 4 days, reading it over 3 or 4 weeks in a translation even into English, or watching a movie about it, these are all very different experiences, and people would respond differently. But exactly what that difference is,
yeah,
much more difficult to.
But here's the thing: you wouldn't limit the effect of the new medium, the new technology, on the thinking. Yes, thinking changes, but clothing changes and older media change. That was really the main point of Marshall saying that.
I don't know what you mean by older media change.
The social structure, like democracy, comes in Greece.
Well, social structures aren't media.
Okay, well, no, McLuhan does mean that. Ah, that's what you miss. He means that's what media are, social structures, as well as ideas, games, all kinds of things. That's why he rejected structuralism. He said, I'm already doing it. I'm doing media, and that's structure. That's a figure ground structure. Well, if that's new to you, just check it out.
It's not new. It doesn't make any sense. It's just throwing words around. It will stick together somehow.
Well, you're like George. What did he say? George the Third said to Gibbons, "Scribble, scribble, scribble." That's what you're accusing me of. They're throwing words around.
Yes, right.
Anyway, okay. Well, for those listening, they can decide if I'm onto something or not. But how do you bring in this part? What McLuhan's theory was not that it was a global village or that the medium was the message. He thought he had solved the mystery of why people did not recognize that the media changed them or conditioned them. And you know what he said? He says it's because the senses are involved, and being involved in a structure, social structure, hypnotizes and numbs a certain kind of sensory bias. New technology comes in, alters...
You mean creates a sensory bias, don't you?
Yeah, creates a sensory bias, and that's a numbness. And then a new technology...
Well, wait. The numbness means that, for example, if you have an auditory, if you have a visual bias, your hearing is numb. Is that what you
right,
mean?
Right. You're a little. Well, no. He says that you're very involved with visual acuity. You're more interested in writing something down than hearing it, and that's an extreme way to say it. But just as a way of making
sure.
The difference.
But what's the numbness mean? That's where you
if you read it closely, when Plato started to write down the oral dialogues, he was numbed visually because it was a novelty. He just had jumped into it, thought it was a breakthrough. He had changed his thinking, was against the poets and all that, and he didn't know that he'd become numbed by the new technology. That's the narcissist effect.
Well, wait a minute. I still don't know what's being numbed.
His eye. By
I thought his eye was being
extended,
enhanced.
Right, but if you read McLuhan closely and understand the media, it also brings in a numbness. People don't know that they're hypnotized by a new situation.
Numbness. You're going to have to go back a little. numbness to me means that my fingers are numb, so I don't feel anything. So it means a sense fails to operate.
Right. All right.
Now, if I'm enhancing my visual, I don't see how that can at the same time numb the visual.
Well, I'm pretty good at McLuhan stuff. I read enough to know that he does say there's a numbing. Now, here's what you'll see.
A numbing of what?
The new the new effect. Like when writing came in, people are engaged in writing, but they're not looking at the effects of writing. They're too enraptured with the novelty of the new technology and don't know what it's going to do. And that's why McLuhan...
Okay, so the numbness here is a cognitive numbness.
Yes,
not a sensory one.
Right.
In other words, you don't see, or excuse me, I shouldn't use that metaphor. You don't recognize it's still seeing. No, it's knowing. You don't recognize what's happening. So the numbness is not of the sense. So it's a transformational use of the term numb. It means a dumbness, really.
Right. That's what happens. So
numbness is an unfortunate choice of epithet, if you ask me, because a sense is enhanced. It's not numbed. But what happens is that you don't recognize this.
Yes.
That you it's changed. So you there's a dumbness or a lack of recognition of the consequences.
Right. That's like when you write in your, I think it's in Theo, the essay on Theo, you talk about the optimism of the 60s. That is a numbness that's caused by the great affluence of new media in the 1560s, you know, with Sputnik and the satellites and electronic music and entertainment. And it when the computer comes in by the end of the 60s and in the 70s, it changes people and they become depressed and gloomy and the optimism goes away. That change is an example of numbness caused by the new technology. So the optimism in perspective was a kind of numbness. It was a blind enthusiasm, everything was going to get better and better and better, which seemed to be to this American society when there was just all this abundance happening in the late 50s and early 60s. You see what I'm saying?
Okay, so that numbness is replaced by an acute awareness?
Of the past. You start looking and tidying up the movies, as you would say, and then the new wave cinema guys come along in France and make a big deal out of the Hollywood movies. You tidy up the past.
Well, the new wave was a 50s phenomenon.
Yes, and that's caused by TV.
That's pre-Sputnik.
No, I'm talking about TV. When I switched, they're a product of TV. So TV comes in, and everybody's engaging it, and they don't know what it's going to do to their family and the whole society. It's going to change everything, and they're just swimming in the new TV thing. But that does allow them to sort of now look at what was the previous new environment, the movies, and they were numbed at the time when the movies were new. Now they wake up and they start repolishing the movies, exemplified by the new wave of two theory that, hey, the Houston and Ford were great directors, but they were not considered great directors when the movie was new and the people were swimming in the new movie world, unaware of its effects and numbed by it, extended and numbed into the novelty. So, and it's good the way McLuhan uses numbness because he's showing it's not a progressive process, you know. It's not so mechanical. There's complexities that come in, and enhancement is, from his perspective, a numbness. So McLuhan would say that the end of the 20th century where reflexivity becomes a cliche, every student knows about it, understands it, they understand Q and it makes sense, that's a numbness caused by the amazing fact you live 200 years every 12 months with the media turnover of the 20th century. It's a new idea. So McLuhan always says the new ideas that attract people are attractive because you're numb, that those new ideas appeal to you due to the new hidden environment.
Well, I taught for 35 years and saw several generations of students, and everything is new to them.
That's right.
Even more, and the later I got in the thing, the more newness there was. That is to say, newness is entirely relative.
I know, but look, that's McLuhan's his point. He used to say that to the blind, to the acoustic cultures, all things are sudden. And he was saying the young, you could take the
beat. Yeah, but to the ignorant, all things are new as well. I mean,
right, but he didn't want to bring in the old cliches of value judgment, so he talked about it technically by using sensory bias and said, to the blind, all things are sudden. That was a famous quote from Alex Layton that he always used. But what you saw were electrified kids, the beatniks, then the hippies, then the yippies, then the yuppies, and then the new waivers, and all those generations that you saw all were numb, and more thought everything was new. You see what I'm saying?
So where do we? I don't know where we're going with this.
Well,
if everything is new, then you don't know anything about. If that's
that's
you can't
right.
You can't make any predictions about how people behave. If
well, that's what happens to society. People don't care. They just assume a sense of newness, and they're numb to that process that they think everything's new.
I thought you said it was new.
No. The kids, we do have new. The beatniks had a different environment than the yippies and the yuppies, and you know I have a chart showing that.
So things are new.
They are new, but people don't understand how to have a perspective, and so they become zombies of the new. And that's what you saw. You saw that your students had less and less understanding of the relevance of the past or any kind of previous old media, because everything was new, and it was like a virtual new or a superficial newness. They weren't given the tools to see that they were just replaying the last 100 years.
Yeah, but that's a function of the collapse of the educational system.
Yeah, which was the effect of the electric environment.
Well, I think that has more to do with with people with bad ideas than with the lack of ideas.
Well, bad ideas are people not having perceptual ideas, McLuhan would say. They're not seeing where ideas come from and why certain ideas are hold on.
Well, the bad idea that causes a lot of ignorance, in my view, is the notion of child-centered learning, so that you let children determine what they want to learn. Or if they want to learn anything.
Right.
Now, how is that caused by technology?
Well, McLuhan used to say, by the 60s, everybody on the, well, at least in the advanced industrial societies, if you don't believe that the Africans were subject to this, even though McLuhan said, no, everybody was affected by the satellite. Okay, take the American society. He said everybody was emotionally a three-year-old. All ages were emotionally 3 years old. That means everybody's like the Simpsons family, and that cartoon mirrors that. It's just everybody for themselves. There's no hierarchy hardly there. And that is why the society thought, well, the kids, now this is where they're numbed. They say, well, they're not aware that their thinking is everybody. No, they're not aware why they think. Since everybody has access to information, we don't need to put a hierarchy on the children. Let them explore themselves. They're involved in this new environment as much as us. That's a numbed response and a bad idea, not understanding why the parents think the kids should be allowed to run free and educate themselves. They're hypnotized by the fact that everybody is made emotionally 3 years old because they're all sharing the same electronic environment. Did you follow that?
Well, I heard what you said, but I don't. I'm not a big fan of single-factor explanations, I guess.
But it's a good factor. It's a powerful factor. It may not be everything, because there's always human stubbornness and human perversity, and people will make themselves resist whatever's going on. There's a lot of people resist the idea of child-centered education, right? They may become the minority.
Not enough.
Yeah, see, there you go. And the reason it's not enough is because the new medium does make the majority fall for the new pattern, the new bias, which is that the kids should be able to run around. It's a post-book world. We all watch TV together, and I think it's a pretty neat idea to look at the Simpsons cartoon is that kind of family. There's no hierarchy in that family.
Yeah.
That's a TV family.
Yeah, but that's standard old-fashioned propaganda. I don't see that that's got anything to do with the medium.
Well, to me, that's Jocko Lil's point, is that the culture is not the messages. The propaganda is in the medium itself, and that's what McLuhan, updated.
Well, that's certainly not what Lil is saying, but it's not what you're saying. You're saying the content is what is affecting people's behavior.
No, I'm saying the
medium. You're saying the fact that the Simpsons has no...
No, I'm not. I'm saying the reason the Simpsons are popular.
Yeah, that's content.
Right, and I'm saying that the reason Simpsons is popular, become maybe the biggest TV show ever, is that it reflects the effect of the electronic world that made everybody in the nuclear family equal, because they're all engaging in the same media, even to the point where the kids know more than the parents about the later technologies, that therefore the Simpsons gets hoiked up as a figure. And it's popular because it mirrors what people are going through, but the people don't know that the electronic media in their home is causing this collapse of the hierarchy. So that's where they think Simpsons is new and funny.
So basically, your argument is it's a feedback mechanism.
Yeah. And McLuhan called that feed forward. What he offered was feed forward. We have too much feedback going on.
The feedback, as you describe it, because you're saying that the Simpsons exemplify.
Feedback, the content, people look for the content, they want to see a mirror of their lives, and they think it's new and exciting, but it's actually a product of a new environment, not a new idea, but it is slightly new that the family has no hierarchy. But that's caused by the electric environment and the people not noticing that when you bring in these new electronic gadgets and give it to your kids for Christmas and their birthdays, that you're destroying the nuclear hierarchy. And so then a TV show comes along, reflects that, and everybody says, wow, isn't this funny? And it's appealing because they're actually, as McLuhan said, entertainment is the strongest form of education because when you're being delighted, you're learning, and they're just seeing a mirror of themselves, of the situation, of their numbness, and they don't know why the family's falling apart. And then they end up complaining about the education system and their kids aren't getting this or that, and you're complaining about the child-centered education. That was an effect dealing with the content of education caused by the environment of electric media, electronic media. And that's what they're numb to. They don't know electronic media made everybody favor child-centered education.
Well, there were people also wrote books about it.
Yeah. Well, that make industries out of it.
Did that not play a role in the triumph of did Marx's books not ever play a role in the rise of communism?
For a while, because my theory is that the reason Marx was popular, say, 1850s, 1880s, is because the telegraph was
Das Kapital was published in 1867.
No, 1848, isn't it?
1867.
Okay, so I said 1860s to 1880s.
The Communist Manifesto was published in 1848.
Oh, that's what I'm thinking of, right. But Das Kapital. So I'm saying the 1860s, 1880s, make it 1900. That last third of the 19th century was the era of the telegraph. And that's the beginning of the discarnate. And so it made the whole world, all workers, all classes, be leveled because they're all experiencing this electrified condition. And that brought in the emotion of multitude that Yeats talked about that made the worker feel solidarity with all the workers around the world. That, and then Marx, it was a figure, conceptualized that emotion, that effect of the telegraph. And then the radio comes in and becomes different. Then fascism comes in with radio.
I think if you want to use the telegraph, you're better with 1867 than 1848.
Yeah, that's what I meant. I said 1850s, 60s to 1880s. But to be precise, if I had to write this, I would look up that date, and I'd have to say 1870 to 1910. That's when Marx and socialism was popular and was powerful. You know, Rosa Luxemburg and everybody. And I'm saying that's an effect of the telegraph press. And then radio changed that. Now, you know, here's what's an interesting idea that people don't know.
Radio brings fascism.
Yes, yeah, tribalism. And in every, you know, you have Churchill, Roosevelt, Mao Zedong later in China, and you got Hitler, and you got the Japanese leaders, and then what you've got, Mussolini. All cultural specificities of a tribalizing effect. But each culture responds differently with their content, right? But they're all having...
Anyway, we seem to be getting off into a rant here.
Okay, we don't want to rant. I just want to tell you this idea.
We should call it a quit.
We will in a minute, but I just want to get this on record. A very unique idea. I only saw McLuhan write it once. He said that Stalin came in because the radio retrieved the medieval Russia. And it required a different kind of leader than Lenin. So it wasn't that Stalin was a Marxist or a Leninist or something. His type of rule was retrieved by radio, and this particular effect in Russia was Stalinism. That's a pretty interesting interpretation of Russia in that phase of creating the Soviet Union. And
it'd be pretty hard to substantiate, too.
Yeah, but, you know, I like new ideas. It's a way of looking at something differently. It's a rare one. So, okay, so we're going to go back. So I'm saying that the reflexivity, you see reflexivity in, say, Peer, in ending with Derrida. In between is McLuhan, Kuhn, and Worf, and who else did I leave out? Well, even Marx.
Marx, I think.
Yeah, Marx begins it. That is a good pattern to work with. And then develop into the complications I've added to it. If you don't accept my complications, then It's interesting that everybody is.
Well, no, no. The thing is, first of all, I'm what I'm doing in that review of Thiel's book is suggesting ubiquity.
Yes.
In our culture at that time, 20 years ago, and I think still today, of the notion that what we think is a product of what we want to think. But the corollary of that, which you didn't mention in until we come to Derrida, I guess, you know, even there you didn't mention, the corollary of that is that it doesn't matter what you believe because there's no truth of the matter. And that's the really nasty and destructive aspect of this notion of reflexivity. If in fact everything we think is a product of what we want to think or what we're brought up to think or what we're programmed to think, however you want to put it, then there's no, you can think this and I can think that, there's no truth of the matter. So it doesn't matter what you think, I'm going to think what I want to think, you think what you want to think, and so that destroys society.
Right, that's the nihilism of cultural relativism, yeah. Right?
Well, it's not just cultural relativism, it's
perceptual.
Perceptualism. It's Pyrrhonism.
What is it? What's the word?
Pyrrhonism. Pyrrhonism.
Right. I've seen that word.
That's a universal skepticism. Pyrrhonism is that there's no truth of the matter.
So what's an antidote? What is the Leon Surratt antidote to that?
Well, I don't have an antidote. But the antidote that are prevailing in our world today are of course. Things like belief systems that are without any warrant, you know.
Right.
Fundamental Christians, fundamental
UFO abductions.
UFO abductions and the of course the Muslims.
Right.
Islamic fundamentalism and all of that. I mean, Eliot said a lot of things I don't much admire, but one thing he said that I think is very much on the mark is that people think, you know, if we stop believing in Christianity or any other religion, that will be a good thing, and that people, you know, will be skeptical and rational and wise. We said,
right,
that's not true. If you get rid of belief systems like Christianity, what will happen is that people will believe in anything. They won't believe in nothing. They'll believe
right.
in anything. And that seems to have been rather prophetic.
Well, McLuhan would then say that's a retrieval of preliterate man, preliterate society.
Yeah, I don't think so. Tribal man believes has very, very, very defined beliefs.
No, that's true, but go back before. He talked about the retrieval of the extreme private individual before tribalism, which would be almost like a caveman. That's another idea people don't know.
Most anthropologists would think there is no before of tribalism.
Right.
Unless you're thinking of Adam and Eve.
Right. Well, McLuhan did. He projected that there was a privacy before tribalism.
Yeah, well, that would be in the Garden of Eden, I guess. Yeah.
Right. Okay.
I don't know if he believed literally. Good Catholic as he was, I don't think he believed literally in Genesis, but perhaps he did. I very much doubt it.
Well, he read the Bible in five languages every day, so he thought something was in there, and he probably read it all.
He may have concentrated on the New Testament, though, don't you think?
No, in a couple of essays, he talks about Old Testament matters.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, I'm sure he's read some of the Old Testament. Yeah.
Right.
Anyway,
okay.
So that's my take on.
No, that's good. So at the end, McLuhan would say the decentralization of electric media fosters multi-consciousness. That's what he says in Cliche Archetype. What you're talking about is the plague of multi-consciousness because nobody can hold the center can't hold it together. The literate centralism doesn't hold together. Christianity is a tough thing in this day to hold together the what we call a revival of paganism and everybody believing whatever they want to believe. That's the disservice.
Yeah, that's not what we see happening. What we see happening instead is a plague of Christian
group,
fundamentalism.
Group mind.
We see group mind, yeah.
We also see extreme extreme individualism, too. You see all of it, all factors, all cultures, all styles, all biases are retrieved and have an industry. Every one of them has an industry.
Well, it seems to me the opposite is taking place.
Well, that's...
Fox News is not representing individual perspectives.
Right, but it's not a majority. maybe it's about one-third. There's two-thirds of people who don't take Fox News seriously at all and celebrate it.
Oh, yeah. Well, sure, yeah. But that's the one-third is a big group thing.
Right, the group Mike McLuhan said would take over, and he's right about that. But he also said that mass man is not tribal. He's both tribal and autonomous. I have a phrase called quadrophenia, not just schizophrenia, quadrophenia. I think that people are developing multiple bodies, technical bodies. That's what I've developed. So
yeah, possibly, yeah. I don't know. But certainly there's a lot of vicious nonsense going on.
That's right. Well, let's hope that our dialogue here will help X-ray the vicious nonsense that's going on.
I hope so.
I think your books are really valuable that you've done, and you've actually made your books, if they were more widely known, would be very popular with the younger generations because they're into conspiracies and the occult up the yin-yang. And you.
Yeah, well, they're still up there on Amazon. Let's hope they'll buy them.
Right. All right. So I don't know if we'll have a part two. We'll keep talking, but we'll see if maybe we will think of it as the effect of what we've done. We might want to do a follow-up. But
yeah, well, that'd be okay. But I think this one's pretty well exhausted.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
I think we're dwindling down to.
All right. Well, thanks a lot. Been talking to Professor Leon Surrett. And he's a man, you should check out his books on Amazon. A Light from Eleusis, The Birth of Modernism, Pound in Purgatory, and Dreams of a Totalitarian Utopia.
And Art in the Age of the Machine, don't forget
that. Oh, yeah, and you have to Kindle that one, right?
Yes.
Yeah, Art in the Age of the Machine, which is a very good primer for any freshman to see who were the thinkers over the last 200 years. You know, that's what's good about that text you put together, because it helps kids who wouldn't get any of that kind of information in high school. It's a great primer to update them on the major Gutenberg galaxy figures. And then electronic age.
I would have thought it was better than a primer, but anyway, thanks for the plug.
No, it's a primer. It's a good primer, but it's simple enough for someone in the first year of university would not have a problem reading it, I don't think. They'd learn a lot about I like the way you emphasize you have a good bunch of chapters on Wyndham Lewis. That's really good. That's brave.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. Well, we'll
right.
sign off.
Yes, I will stop the recording here. Let me just see what happens here.